I'm Christopher Lydon, and here we go again. Bob Rowe was a middle-class Brooklyn guy of his time, the 50s and 60s into the 70s, a lawyer, an insurance claims adjuster, a day sailor, an opera fan. He became a hero and role model in a circle of families bonded by the chance burden of severe retardation among their kids. Bob Rowe was every couple's example of patience in tribulation, until the dreadful day in 1978 when he smashed his three children and then his wife to death with a baseball bat. Julie Solomon's search of the facts, the law, the psychiatry, the morality of the case makes it a story for all time. How does a good man erupt in intimate murder? If Bob Rowe was innocent by reason of insanity, as the court said, was he entitled to the freedom and new love he found? What about forgiveness, compassion, the new life he insisted on seeking? Julie Solomon's Facing the Wind is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from ENA, Eric Nelson Architects, providing creative solutions for living and working on the web at ena-ma.com. And from Gail Leander Public Relations, helping authors publicize their progressive books. Contact glpr at aol.com. And from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci. I'm Christopher Lydon. Bob Rowe got away with murder, or maybe he didn't. Almost 25 years ago, he killed his wife and three children with a baseball bat. He pled insanity, and after spending 2 years in a New York State psychiatric institution, he was released. For the rest of his life, he was determined to convince the world that he was not a monster, and that he was entitled to recapture his law license and pretty much all he had achieved. He got back a lot. He remarried a woman 30 years younger than he. He had another child and lots of devoted friends. Yet his life was a misery of tormented memories and hopeless obsessions. Our guest, Julie Solomon's telling of the Bob Rowe story, bristles with questions about what makes men come apart, questions about infanticide, the insanity defense, second chances, and the limits of forgiveness. What do you say in the end about a man who kills his family and wants to start his life again? Our phone is 1-617-450-2923. Join the conversation with Julie Solomon about her book, Facing the Wind. Julie Solomon, thank you for a significant story, brilliantly told. It's not the story you set out to tell. Tell us about the turn in the road when it became Facing the Wind.
The book I set out to tell was a story of a group of women who had all had children who were blind. Some had additional handicaps. They first met in the early 1970s when this support group was formed, and they were still friends 25 years later. And I was interested in sort of how their friendship helped them overcome adversity. I knew about Bob Rowe's wife, Mary, his first wife, was a member of the women's group. And I knew about the killing from the outset, but to me it was just part of the story. This was going to be about this group, how their friendship was born with the birth of their children, and how it was sealed with the killing of one of their friends. But I didn't think that the Rowe story would take over and dominate the book at the outset.
What is your judgment in the end about the place of the very gravely handicapped son Christopher in this story? Christopher was blind. He was brain damaged from the beginning. Is that a part of the story in the end?
Oh, it's a huge part of the story, and the mother's group remained a huge part of the story, because even though much of the book focuses on Bob Rowe's odyssey, because it is so dramatic and it does raise other questions, part of the investigation of the book is to say all of us face chaos in our lives. All of us face difficulties. Some people find a way to endure them and some people don't. Bob Rowe was one of the people who didn't. And Christopher was certainly his greatest burden. And for many years, Bob Rowe was a very, very good father to Christopher, a model father.
The group thought he was the best in their circle for a kind of equanimity. He was also rather pragmatic. He said at some point that if keeping Christopher at home became an insufferable burden on the family, they would do something about it. He was not should we say, militant, or he was not inflexible on the subject, but he was loving, he was caring. He supported his wife in at every turn, it seemed.
That's right, and I think he didn't set out to be a martyr to Christopher. On the other hand, I do think that part of his character was to be the very best at whatever he did. He was from a working class family. He was the first person in his family to go to college. And I think he was very bent on his ideas of success were he didn't want to be president, he didn't want to be fabulously wealthy, but he did want to fulfill some notion of the all-American life.
He wanted his son Bobby to love Puccini, Tosca, and La Boheme the way he did. It's multidimensional. This is a real person.
He's a real person, and he had high aspirations. He was extremely well-read. He had a huge library. And I think that at first, Christopher's birth defects were very difficult for him to accept. Once he did accept it, then I think he decided to approach Christopher the way he approached the rest of the life, the rest of his life, that he was going to be the best father of a handicapped child. And I think in some ways, wanting to be the best at such a difficult task is ultimately self-destructive, because I think part of what you have to accept is being the best is understanding that your life can't continue exactly the way that it did before.
You got to know an awful lot about Bob Rowe and a real feeling for him without meeting him. Why didn't you?
I didn't meet him because when I started doing the research on the book almost 6 years ago, because my first interest were the women in the mothers group, I had spent a great deal of time trying to get to know them. Also, to be honest with you, I was a little afraid of approaching Bob Rowe. This was a man who had killed his family with a baseball bat. I have two young children. My youngest at the time was just a few months old when I began the reporting on this book. And I think I was delaying meeting him, not knowing that he was ill at the time. Also, his court records had been sealed because under the law, as a defendant who had been declared not guilty, he was entitled to have his record sealed. And before I approached him, I wanted to know as much about him as I could. So there were two reasons for the delay. And then I began bombarding him with letters and with my former books and anything I could to persuade him that I wasn't trying to do a tabloid story. I wasn't trying to condemn him, but to understand him. And then by the time I finally got the court records unsealed, which was a long legal process, he died.
As a reporter, Julie Salomon, I mean, you reflect the inhibitions that all of us would have, the questions, the puzzlement, maybe the fear, the dread that the monster was still alive in him. What's your, after all this research and after his death now, what is your judgment about the degree of his madness, the degree of his recovery, the measure of his goodness and evil?
I think my conclusion at the end is that I think we can never truly know anybody. I think that even ourselves, I mean, I think about this quite a lot, especially after hearing and studying so much about Bob Rowe, that I think what I find so frightening about the case is that here's a man, I've seen videotapes of him with his second wife, and he seems like an affable, nice guy who you'd like to talk to at a party. And then I think of him killing his family with a baseball bat. And it's frightening to me because I always like to, I think that I couldn't do something like that, but then we don't know. And I think these kinds of questions come up over and over again. You know, now we have Bob Carey, who everybody perceives of as a fine man and as much as one can be a good politician. And then he has this dark memory in his past, and how do we judge people? So I wish I did have an answer, but then I think
wartime,
I'd either be
Shirley,
a rabbi.
Wartime is a book unto itself. Let's stick with the pressures on Bob Rowe. The details of the murder and his testimony about it later just compound the questions. He said he had thought, and one can believe him, that he might have been saving his child and all his children from a life of poverty and misery. He thought he was doing them a favor. He persuaded himself he was doing a favor. He was also under terrible job pressure, downward mobility. There was also the mere fact, or the unchangeable fact, of Christopher's rather grotesque handicaps. Have you sorted those out?
Well, I do think part of it, part of the pressures that were weighing on Bob Rowe was certainly his career had taken a turn. And so instead of being on the upward track, he was on the downward track. But also with Christopher, Christopher was a very cute little boy. And so when he was small, even though he had these disabilities, it was every small achievement he accomplished was a huge event. When he was able to go to the bathroom by himself, if he could walk a few steps when the doctor had said that he wouldn't be able to, these were tremendous accomplishments. And I think accomplishments that Bob and Mary could take pride in. As he was getting older and bigger, he wasn't as cute anymore, and I think this is a problem that many people find with disabled children, that that children who are just cute because they're small and your expectations are lower become more difficult to accept and to deal with as they grow older. And I think that all of these things converged on Bob Rowe at the same time.
Everything is contradictory here. He wanted to be a perfect father of a handicapped child. He also said later that if Christopher had been normal, he wouldn't have lost it.
I think that's true. I think that's true because I think you're right. It is. I think the desire is in itself contradictory. To be the perfect, the notion of being a perfect father when everything is fine is a very, very difficult achievement. But to do it when you have a child who, what does it mean to be the perfect father of a handicapped child? It means to be patient beyond imagination, self-sacrificing beyond imagination. And I think that's asking an awful lot of anyone. And somebody who then has a mental disability, it's maybe asking the impossible.
He stood with a bat in his hand for some time over his able son Bobby's body before he killed him. Can you imagine his head at that, in that half hour?
I didn't try to imagine his head, but Bob Rowe was a voluminous writer. He left behind all kinds of stories, short stories he wrote about his own experience. He left behind journals and diaries, which his second wife ultimately allowed me to read. And I think that his relationship with Bobby was extremely close. Bobby, by all accounts, was a very lively, charming young boy, and I think Bob saw in Bobby everything that he wanted as a father. And I think that to kill Bobby, for him, he had to convince himself that this was an act of love, because he did love those children. I think that that's absolutely true.
Can you describe that awful day when he dispatched three children, asked them to play a game, close their eyes, and then basically repeated it with his wife, Mary, when she came home from work that evening?
Well, you have to understand that before that night, you know, people say to me, well, did he just snap? And I say, no, he didn't just snap. He had been severely depressed for a couple of years. 2 years before he killed his family, he began suffering from delusions, hallucinations. And one day, he asked his wife, Mary, to go get the next-door neighbor to come over and tie him up, to tie Bob to the banister, because he had a vision that his mother had come to him and said, I want you to kill Mary and the kids. This was 2 years earlier. So Mary did this, and the neighbor came, and Bob was taken to Gracie Square, to a private mental hospital, where he spent 6 weeks. And after his discharge, he never really became quote-unquote normal again. He never really became the Bob that people had known before. He started seeing a psychiatrist. He began taking medication, and the medication made him very sleepy and groggy, and so his work suffered from it. And eventually he lost his job. He changed jobs a couple of times. He lost his job, so that by the time he killed the family, he was already in a state of depression. Mary had gone back to work, which, you know, this was in 1978, at that time, he, growing up in the era that he did, he felt that this was a shame, that he had, that he wasn't able to support his family. So every day, Mary would go off to work, and he was home with Christopher while the other two children went to school. And I think more and more, in his depression, he began to identify with Christopher. Christopher was disabled. Bob felt as though he was disabled. And I think that he was falling more and more into a world unto himself and seeing himself more and more as a burden on his family instead of the supporter of his family. And then as he described it in his own writing and in many conversations with psychiatrists, he woke up one morning in February, a snowy morning, and he felt for the first time that he had clarity, that he understood what he had to do. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like his previous delusion where his mother was giving him commands to go kill his family. He felt that he had found the solution to his problem. And the solution was that he had to kill them and he had to kill himself. And from his years as a claims adjuster for an insurance company, he did a lot of medical research, and he knew or felt he knew exactly how to kill his family so that they wouldn't suffer, so that the children would die immediately. Mm. And he did it in order. He first killed Bobby because he was the one who would be the most conscious and would be the danger to the plan. And then this took place over a period of several hours. Christopher and Jennifer, it was during school break in the winter, so the children were home. Christopher and Jennifer had slept in, and then Bob told them to watch television together. So they were in a room together. Christopher and Jennifer were very close. Jennifer was the youngest child, who was quite close to Christopher. She was adopted because Bob and Mary hadn't known what had caused Christopher's birth defects. And the children were in the next room. So then next he killed Jennifer, and then finally Christopher. And
the clarity of his purpose sort of stayed with him to the end of the day.
To the end of the day. And the time period is somewhat murky, but many, many hours passed, and he was there with his children in the house, just sitting, apparently. And then he asked Mary to come home from work, that he had a surprise for her. And she came home from work, and she stood in the middle of the living room, and then he killed her. And then he spent the night driving.
He tried to kill himself in the gas oven. One always wonders, and it was argued in his case, whether he really meant to spare himself or not. What do you believe?
I think that, like everything else with Bob Rowe, this was a contradiction. I think he wanted to kill himself because he felt he should. I think he also had a tremendous drive towards life. And I think that was that drive towards life, which had seemed so admirable before, now became disgusting and repellent to a lot of people. And I think he wanted to kill himself, but I think that had he really wanted to kill himself, he would have found a way. He was a very smart man who knew how to do that. But I think that he told himself he wanted to kill himself. And this is conjecture on my part, obviously, but I think, yes, he did want to kill himself, but I think that he also didn't want to kill himself.
Julie Solomon's account of Bob Rowe's family murder in 1978 is called Facing the Wind. You can join the conversation at 617-450-2923. Stand by, Julie. Dr. Stephen Teach is on the line. He was Bob Rowe's psychiatrist for the last 10 years of his life. And he testified for Bob Rowe's reinstatement in the law profession. Dr. Stephen Teach, what does psychiatry and psychology understand about what the court called insanity, how it might have arrived, how it could have, you know, left him afterward, how he could have recovered?
Well, insanity is a legal term, so I think maybe I'll answer your question in terms of mental illness. Probably the most central issue in mental illness, other than biological predeterminations, which people are thinking there are some, at least in some people, is that there is conflict. and conflict that is non-resolvable results in confusion and pain. That the normal methods of solving things that people have had during their lives fail, and that they don't know what to do, and they go into deep confusion. One of the things that Julie mentioned is that on the day or a couple of days before, probably maybe the day before, it seemed he suddenly seemed to feel better. That's a very dangerous time with any depressed person, because depressed people are in the midst of pain. They're looking for something to relieve the pain, and they're confused about what they can do. And if they develop a plan, they feel better. So it's a very important time when somebody seems to suddenly feel better to watch that they're not on some kind of destructive plan. And very often you get suicides or other actions in the immediate aftermath of people seeming to become better from depression. Because the confusion is lifted.
You speak as if you've seen it a lot.
Oh, yes. It's one of the things that's written about a lot, well known, and yet under a lot of the pressures that exist in psychiatry, especially now with managed care and all sorts of things to do things in specific times, tends to get missed, unfortunately. Yeah, people get better, and a managed care company says, well, they better get them out of the hospital. And that's not the time to get them out of the hospital. You want to keep them there, or you want to keep them under good observation to find out what they're thinking that has helped them feel better and to understand it before you do that.
What is your name for the affliction that drove Bob Rowe?
Well, he clearly had a what's called major depressive disorder, and he had psychotic features with it. You know, he initially...
The formal diagnosis was major depressive episode with mood congruent psychotic features. What does that mean? And what does it say about the, you know, the what may have been a temporary...
It wasn't temporary at all. This was something, as Julie said, had gone on for almost 2 years, or about 2 years, maybe a little longer, since he had his first major depressive episode. It also has to do with the realities of traumas in life, and not just the ones that are occurring at that time, but also previous ones that somehow were not fully resolved. One of the important things is to understand what his childhood had been, what things he was carrying forward. And in something like a hallucination of his mother, why would he hallucinate that? What would that be? Because that's a creation of his own mind, something coming from his mind that carries that message. And very frequently you see that there are traumas in childhood that existed at the time. People grew past them, went and did things, but they stayed there like, sort of like unhealed wounds that you can go on and live around until something very similar comes and gets on it again, and it's very sensitive.
Everything about this story is complex. Bob Rowe claimed later that if Christopher had been normal, this never would have happened. People are puzzled if he had taken the Allstate promotion and moved to Illinois, it wouldn't have happened. The judge said if he'd been examined by mental health professionals 2-3 years earlier, it wouldn't have happened. In what way?
I think all of those are true, or at least probably true, that any one of the pressures on him, had they not been there.
But so in what sense did you believe he was curable or treatable afterward?
Oh, he certainly was. One of the main things, it didn't happen right away. Maybe his psychosis cleared up, but his depression didn't clear up for years.
It seems not to have cleared up at all. He spoke,
that's not true.
Well, forgive me, and I don't mean to be judgmental at all, but he writes later, a lot later, that he's descending into hell again, that the hell of his life has returned.
Well, that's true. He went into another kind of illness after he had triple bypass surgery. And we've learned somewhat later that the machines that were used very often created clots that were sent around the body, and it affected his liver. And he ended up with a liver cirrhosis and had not been a drinker or could find no other sources for it, that created such chemical imbalances in him that he had a hard time at times thinking, and ultimately resulted in his death from liver cancer. So he went through another very severe kind of trauma that by itself would have stressed most anybody.
You're saying in a lot of different ways, Dr. Teach, that this is a crisis that could befall an awful lot of people and does afflict many, many people. What's your moral for all of us as human beings, as citizens, as people who find this,
I think for me, the most important thing, and it is always the most important thing, and it may seem like a cliche coming from psychiatry, but it has to do with the health of the child-rearing process, how people grow up in their own childhood, and how much trauma they experience, and not just the trauma, but how much that trauma is healed during their childhood, or how much it's left. Because if there's a really traumatic childhood, without healing, without support, without some kind of real love around it, it leaves people carrying burdens through their lives that make them more vulnerable, and ultimately, depending upon what their experiences are later, it may seem like they go through life, but just like the camel who carries a lot, you put the last load on and he collapses.
You know, can I just observe as a reader, and then you respond to me, that there's something missing here. As James Stewart remarked in a marvelous review of this book in the New York Times, he said, perversely, the very horror of the crime, the murder of three children and his wife, seemed to work in Bob Rowe's favor in that it established insanity almost on its face. At the same time, there is a strange... there's a strange gap in Bob Rowe's address to this this history as long as he lives. He never seems quite to get... He speaks very touchingly about the family that he lost. On the other hand, there's something missing in the grief and the understanding. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, one of the things that we worked on that was very difficult for him was to feel he had a right to grief. Because even though he knew that he was in the midst of a mental illness at the time, he also knew that his physical body did the killing. But it wasn't his mind as he knew it in almost the totality of his life that did it. And so he couldn't have remorse. Because he didn't feel it was he, as he understood himself, who had done this, but he who was ill. And attached to that was a feeling that somehow he couldn't grieve because he also was the physical body who had done it. And one of the things we worked with was to try to help him actually grieve the loss of his family. It was a very, very difficult thing to bring through to him because he didn't feel he had the right to it.
Dr. Stephen Teach, this is... deeply fascinating, and all of the questions seem better than the answers in a way, and not any of them may be resolvable. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for your work. We're talking about the Bob Rowe story, which Julie Solomon has written in marvelous detail and seriousness, the story of a man who killed three children and his wife, got back his freedom, but not his life. The true story of tragedy and reconciliation, as she says. We'll be back after a short break. Audio streaming is provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting comes from Pagito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development. www.pagetto.com, and from Align Incorporated, a Boston-area Java engineering and consulting firm. Also from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. I'm Christopher Lydon. Julie Solomon is our guest. Her book is called Facing the Wind, the true story, exhaustively, not just researched, but considered and felt about Bob Rowe, a Brooklyn man, rather a everyman of his time, who killed his three children and his wife, pleaded insanity, was declared innocent, and lived 20 more years with a new wife, but not the new life he strove for. Julie Solomon, the book begins and ends with the circle of mothers of brain-damaged children, in which Bob Rowe was a star. And it ends with his wife, his second wife's visit with these mothers, some of whom were on the line, in which they can't meet. They can't meet in compassion and understanding and reconciliation about a man that, in different ways, they all, at different times, had admired and loved. I wish you'd introduce the mother's view again, and then the mothers who are with us.
Well, the mothers, like Mary Rowe, like Bob Rowe, this was a group of mothers whose children were blind or had severe visual impairments. Some of the children had brain damage, some of them didn't. When these women first met, they were all, their children were enrolled at the nursery school at what was then called the Industrial Home for the Blind in Brooklyn. It's now Helen Keller Services. And they were lost because some of them had other children. For some, this was their first child. And all of a sudden, instead of having a normal baby with the usual problems, they had children who had highly unusual problems. And you have to completely rethink the way that you raise a child, even if you're an experienced mother. You have to teach your baby to chew. They can't see you do it. You can smile at your baby, but your baby isn't going to see you smile. So there's all kinds of just small and huge ways that you don't know how to deal with the child who's your baby, and yet you love the child. Once you get over the shock, I was amazed at the depth of the love that these women have for their children. Not amazed, but I think so, because, you know, I think all of us, that's our great fear, is what would we do in that situation? And Edith Pat, who was the social worker at the Industrial Home for the Blind, saw that these women, there weren't many services available to parents at that time of children, and she realized that one of the people who could probably help them the best were each other, and so she began having them meet, and they became what we would now call a support group. And I think these are fascinating women. I came to admire and to really like the women in the group that much. They were a very diverse group, the group that stayed together. One was a black woman, one was Irish, another was Jewish. They were women who probably wouldn't have become friends in another situation, and yet because of the birth of their children, they became closest friends. They could reveal things to each other that they couldn't reveal to anybody else, and they could also laugh with each other. I mean, there's a certain kind of dark humor that grows up around families with disability that I think is very hard for people outside to appreciate. So, you know, for example, you know, a mother whose child has a false eye, you know, not too many people are going to understand the joke when the false eye pops out and lands in a basket of Easter eggs and they have to dig it out. You know, there's this kind, and yet in the mother's group, they could find solace and friendship and help, pragmatic help on just how to get things done. And I know you've invited a couple of the mothers to be on the show, which is wonderful because it's been, you know, and just to put their place in the book. So, you know, I think
I wish you'd introduce them, starting with, you know, with Rose Morrow and also Mady Gaskin.
Well, Rose is a woman who has several children, and Anne Morrow, her daughter, was actually born the night that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And Anne was an extremely premature baby, which was what led to her blindness. And the hospital at first was declaring Anne a miracle baby because she was a pound or slightly more than a pound when she was born, and she survived, and everybody was thrilled that this baby who everybody had written off for dead was going to be gone. She spent most of her first months in an incubator, and being watched, you know, and being pumped oxygen. And then when the miracle baby, it turned out, was blind, the hospital no longer wanted to use her in a brochure they'd been planning to distribute to show their wonderful child-saving techniques. And Rose, Anne has grown now. She's a lively, smart young woman who's a big science fiction fan. Rose is her mother.
Rose, I'd like to welcome you to the conversation.
Hi. I'm here.
Hi, Rose.
Hi, Julie.
In the book, Rose Morrow, you articulately remembered envying Bob and Mary Rowe's marriage.
Right.
Give us your picture of it.
Well, Bob Rowe was like the husband that we all wanted because him and Mary communicated so well. And no matter what happened, it seemed like they were together on everything. And I guess, well, I'm not going to speak for everybody, but my husband and myself, we didn't have that communication. My husband seemed to leave everything up to me, like, well, okay, whatever you want to do, you do. And it was kind of left on my shoulders to do whatever I had to do. And yet when we were with Bob and Mary, they were so together.
What made you think it was authentic, that it wasn't a cover for the terrible pressures that they were under? What do you now think it was?
Well, at the time, it was very authentic. I mean, he was marvelous, you know, and Mary, too. Mary and I became very close because we lived near each other. And when we used to go to our meetings, I used to pick her up, and she used to drive with me. And many times Bob drove with me, too, because he worked right around where we used to have our meetings. So I got pretty close to both of them, and it was very authentic. And then later on, when we found out, it was like when he had his problem and when he was first committed to an institution for, 6 weeks, I think it was, then we all became very concerned about him because after that, I moved from Brooklyn to Long Island, and they came to my house, and then that's when the dramatic change took place. He seemed to be sitting in a corner, and, I mean, he would be the life of the party, so, you know, in a certain way, you know, we'd all gather around him and to tell stories, and he always had everybody laughing and happy, and yet he just sat in the chair in the corner.
So you saw the illness coming, in a sense, but what was it? What was the problem? Did Christopher have anything to do with it? Was it his job? Was it?
I guess it was a combination of both. And Mary would say that he was depressed and he just couldn't take it anymore. He couldn't go to work and he didn't want her to work and he just couldn't handle what was happening to his life. And I guess it affected him and Mary. And Mary became very leery because when we had our meeting right before this all took place. She was very nervous. She came to our meeting, and she was pacing back and forth, and she was making phone calls, and she kept saying, oh, you know, I'm so concerned about Bob. I'm really nervous about leaving him with the kids, and I don't know what to do. So and we kept saying, well, Mary, if this, and she was scared. She knew something was going to happen.
Mady Gaskin, did you anticipate trouble here? Did you share the affection for Bob Rowe?
Absolutely. I would sound like... I'm repeating exactly what Rose said. They were a wonderful couple who lived in a beautiful house and had wonderful neighbors, and they got along so well. It's astounding that a person can be two people almost.
What is your human judgment of what happened to Bob Rowe, Mady Gaskin?
You know, mine is really quite simplistic, and it sounds simplistic, because I think that he wanted everything to be perfect, and he thought for a long time that he could make it perfect. If he didn't like something, he could change it. And like when he didn't like the way Mary dressed, he could tell her how to dress and what to wear. And he did that. And when Christopher was born, he decided that he could really cure it, because he delved into talking about it, to talking to other people, to go into a patterning exercise. He had all the neighbors involved, and he was really orchestrating Christopher's cure. And it didn't happen. Mm. And I think when he found out he could no longer control everything that he was in contact with, he began to deteriorate.
Mm.
And I may or may not be right, but when he got well and he married again, he started down the same path. He started to tell her how to dress, what to do, to go to school. And he started to orchestrate her life. He orchestrated everything. And when it didn't work out right, it was devastating to him.
There's a most extraordinary close of this book in which Colleen, his second wife, comes and meets with the mothers who had known him before the murders. It's a most extraordinary and unsatisfying confrontation of women who all saw virtues in Bob Rowe, but the earlier mothers cannot reconcile themselves with this story.
No.
And Julie, I wish you'd sort of tell us what happened, but also why I can imagine why you, for the reasons of the story, but why Colleen and the mothers wanted to meet and talk about this horror.
What had happened was I had finally approached Bob Rowe. He died, and then I began talking to Colleen, his second wife, who ultimately decided to help me with the book. And she opened up, not only gave me Bob's letters and journals and letters that they had written to each other and all kinds of writings of his and annotations and books, and introduced me to friends of his who had remained friends subsequent to the killings. But when I first met her, and we had our first, not first met her, but when we had our first long interview, we began discussing the mothers group. And she knew only a little bit about them. And I think it began to, she had heard of Edith Pat, the social worker. But I think she thought she knew everything about Bob's former life. And I think she realized that she didn't. And I think also the fact that these women had been so close to Bob and Mary and then seemed to hate him or seemed to hate him. I think that she wanted to meet them partly to change their minds, or if not to change their minds, at least to tell them that Mary and the children hadn't been erased and forgotten, that the slate hadn't been wiped clean, that their memories were kept alive. She wanted to vindicate her husband. She really loved him. And so I think that was her motivation. I think for the women, Mady and Rose can talk to it, but I think in general it was also several things. They had been left with a sense of incompletion. This woman and man who they'd been very close to had all of a sudden vanished from their lives, and they were left hanging. What had happened to Bob Rowe? Who was this man? I think there was no resolution, but I think they wanted to find some answers at least to their questions. And I also think that at least some of the women wanted to find out if he had suffered at all, because I think there would be some gratification in that as well.
Mady, you described the meeting as eerie, difficult, surreal. Tell us.
First of all, there was a lot of animosity, but we were extremely curious as to what kind of woman would marry a man who had killed his wife and children. So what we were, it was curious about her. And we had discussed it for a while, and before she came to the meeting, everybody was kind of nervous and on edge. And I guess we all came with the same agenda. let's find out what the heck is wrong with this woman. It had to be something terribly wrong with her that made her marry a man like that.
Do you still believe that?
Yeah, I do. I think
I agree with Mary, too.
Rose?
I agree with Mary. I think that he controlled her the way he controlled everybody else, and I think she thrived on that because she never had anything to look. I mean, he was a father figure for her.
Yeah.
And I think that's what she used him for, was to be her father. And, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, if I could just say something.
Julie,
please. It's true she did thrive on it, and I think that even though it is mystifying to me how anybody could marry somebody with Bob Rowe's background, and Colleen knew about it almost from the outset, you know, you say he was controlling. It's true, but I think he was also very helpful to her. I think they were very helpful to each other. I think that they were both damaged people who found each other at a moment
exactly.
in time. And whether it's something that we would want to emulate, I think it's understandable.
And I don't think she would have became what she became without him.
He wouldn't. Well, no. I think he needed her to save him, and she needed him
right.
to save her.
Exactly.
And I think that was the kabuki dance that they did.
What degree, I mean, how much imagination does it take to find compassion for a father who, under terrible pressure and illness, kills his child? This is a dreadful subject, but how many mothers have been in that place for a nanosecond? How many mothers have in that group could deal with a murderous impulse?
I don't think we could.
No. I don't think.
I think they could have the murderous impulse. I think it's the acting out on the murderous mm-hmm. impulse that mm-hmm. was. I think in fact, a view of the mothers had said at one time or another, at least one of them, that she had had that fantasy of I'll kill my child, I'll kill myself, but then she didn't do it. And I think having the impulse and overcoming it actually, I think, makes you less sympathetic to a certain extent.
In a certain sense, Bob Rowe was so far ahead of all the group, you know, in everything that he did. And then it got to a point where we kind of jumped ahead of him, and he went back. Hmm. So we all survived, and he didn't.
Well, that's a good point, Rose, because I think, by and large, we were survivors,
right.
and being part of the group enabled us to survive
exactly. mm-hmm.
even better than we had envisioned.
Mm-hmm. And we have even PAC to be thankful for that, and social workers.
Yes.
They're underestimated.
what is your hindsight on your own husbands who suffered by comparison with Bob Rowe before the murders? They were silent. They didn't deal with it. They
no.
left too much
no.
to you.
No.
But in the end, they didn't kill their children. They didn't
That's
kill
right.
you.
That was the point we made to each other. Was
right.
after this happened, we went, well, we all love Bob Rowe. We all wish that our husbands can be like him. But also, our husbands didn't kill us.
No.
We survived, and they survived.
Hmm.
And our children survived.
Yeah, and my husband left all the decisions to me, too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whenever there was an operation suggested, I had to make the decision. New medication, I had to make the mm-hmm. decision. To put him in a home, I had to make the decision.
Hmm. Well, you know, Julie Solomon made the point earlier that for Bob Rowe, wanting to be the best was a self-destructive impulse.
Absolutely.
Stephen Scaring is on the line. He was Bob Rowe's defense lawyer in the murder trial, who very successfully and quickly got him free on an insanity defense. Stephen Scaring, would you do it again?
Would I do what again? Get him free on an insanity
defense?
Yeah,
would you take the insanity defense route?
Absolutely. This was
Would you win it again?
Absolutely. This was one of those very, very rare cases where you can win a case on the insanity defense, because it's precisely the kind of case for which the insanity defense was written. The law recognizes that you shouldn't punish somebody for his conduct if he doesn't have an appreciation of the wrongfulness of it. And if that the reason he has no appreciation is as a result of mental disease. The classic example is where somebody believes that they're squeezing an orange and they're actually choking somebody. In Bob Rowe's case, it was clear that he was a decent human being, that he loved his family, but he had a delusion, and it was so quite so clear that he had this delusion that told him this was the right thing to do for his family. He was afraid that because he had lost his job, his children would be left, and his family, and especially Christopher, would be left to social services, and they would end up in a community that wouldn't have any respect for his family, and that his family would suffer for the rest of their lives. And he just couldn't deal with that.
But, you know, the public, including me, I think it's we're led by the Son of Sam story or the John Hinckley case, assumes that people who do these unthinkable things and plead insanity will spend the rest of their time in an institution.
Well, that may be so, except that in Bob Rowe's case, it was quite clear from the moment that he woke up and he no longer had the burden that caused him to follow through on this delusional thought, he was okay. I mean, it was the pressure of the situation that caused him to suffer this delusional thinking. And once that was over, in the strangest way, Bob was normal. And of course, the psychiatrists who the prosecution had examined him realized that, but understood that you had to go back to the history and see why he did it.
This is precisely the point of which that the mothers couldn't accept, and it's the lesson that the Bar Association or that prevented him from getting his lawyer's work back too.
Well,
what's the wisdom here?
Well, becoming a lawyer again is another issue. You know, that implicates other issues because you're going to be representing people, etc. But in terms of a jury's reaction, in this case, we went with a judge, not a jury, because it was so clear cut, it was so precise, and it was unnecessary to burden a jury with this problem because it was my view and even the prosecutor's view that the judge would find him not guilty by reason of insanity, as he did. But let me tell you that there is a misperception as to how widely accepted the defense is. I mean, it is a very rare case, probably less than 5% of the cases that go to trial on the insanity defense where there is an acquittal. The public does not allow for someone to commit a crime unless they truly believe that the person was insane at the time and had no appreciation. And typically, where a defendant is acquitted, it involves the killing of his family as opposed to someone outside of the family, because the public generally doesn't feel threatened in the case where the victims are the family, whereas they do feel threatened where the victims are outside the family. Oddly enough, the Son of Sam case occurred at the exact same time, and they were both in the same facility at the same time in Brooklyn.
Which is the misperception, that Son of Sam is more dangerous or that Bob Rowe is less dangerous because he killed his nearest and dearest?
The perception, not misperception, is that Bob Rowe is less dangerous and that the Son of Sam is dangerous. Now, there's a case where a jury is not going to convict him. It doesn't matter how bizarre his conduct is. It doesn't matter how bad his prior history is. I mean, he's just not going to be acquitted. There's no jury that's going to come in and say, we're going to let him back out again because they feel threatened by him. And so the law in those cases is of little value to a defendant, and arguably as it should be. I mean, let's face it, there are bigger issues sometimes, and those bigger issues are protecting the public, but there was never any fear that Bob Rowe was going to kill again after this.
Well, in the book, there's enough excitement to keep you reading. There's enough uncertainty to keep you reading. I want to go back to the mothers for the human judgment here, because they knew Bob Rowe's tribulation as a parent. They admired his resilience under that pressure. They enjoyed him personally. And yet, and they had laughed with him. They had lived with what they thought was the same problem, and yet they also find a block to forgiveness, to compassion in the last meeting. I wish you'd, Rose Morrow and Mady Gaskin, talk about it. Talk about how we should all feel in this situation.
That's impossible to say how all should feel, because even among us, we all felt differently. Some of the mothers were more adamant and hated him and despised him more than others. I guess I am much older and not prone to hold a whole lot of vindictiveness or hate or anything. I find it kind of counterproductive. I just chalked it up to, well, I don't like him. I would not like to be around him ever again, and I don't want any parts of him. But I don't hate him.
I think most of the mothers felt that, as far as hating him, I think that's a strong word, but
it is.
They felt like he, why did he go on and have a life when he took four?
Yes.
And I think that's the biggest thing, I think, of all the mothers. They felt he wasn't entitled to a life. He went on, he got married, he had another child. He shouldn't have been entitled to that. He should have, I don't know what he should have done. I can't answer that question, but
he should have stayed incarcerated.
Yeah, he should have stayed incarcerated. You know, maybe he wouldn't have killed anybody that wasn't a family member, but like the lawyer said, you know, like he probably wasn't like Son of Sam. But we just felt like he shouldn't have been entitled to a life. He shouldn't have been entitled to get out of a mental institution and then go on and live his life when he took four lives that could have gone on very well without him. Mary would have survived without him. She would have survived, and so would have Bobby and Christopher and Jennifer. They all would have survived.
That's
they didn't
what
need
we
him,
felt.
But he figured they did need him. So that
why
was
didn't
point.
He leave? Why didn't he just walk out and go away?
And not kill them. Let them live their own lives. Why make a decision for somebody? Nobody has that right to take their lives because that's how you feel like.
Well, that was his controlling factor,
yeah,
I guess.
Of course.
Part of the obstacle, it seems to me, is that you don't believe even in 20 years that he did live, he came to a satisfactory understanding of it, and that his second wife, Colleen, didn't really get her mind around this horror, even to this day.
No, she was bent on making us like him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And forgiving him and saying what a wonderful person he was.
Right. How much he loved him and how much he needed him. And I guess he needed her, too, but I don't know. We just couldn't. I couldn't resolve myself to say that what he did was. You could forgive.
And how much he still loved Mary, because they used to go to the cemetery together, and there were pictures around the house, and that we shouldn't think of him the way we did.
Julie Solomon, part of the story at the close is that Colleen, his second wife, is still living with this story, and she's also having to tell their daughter about it. At age 9, how do you imagine that story presenting itself now?
I think it's very hard for her and for her child. I feel sorry for the child because, I don't know, I imagine how when people read this book and find out what her father was, I think they're going to judge her very badly.
But they won't know her.
No.
Julie
they
Solomon,
won't know, but
how is the story settling in Colleen's life and to tell to her daughter, Barbara?
I think Colleen wanted to have a record. I think the reason she participated in the book was so that there would be a record so that her daughter would have an ability to judge for herself. I think she wanted her to see that there were people who thought her father were evil, and that was the picture presented certainly in the tabloids at the time of the killing, that there were people who were deeply hurt by what he did, but that in Colleen's view, that he was able to perform some good afterwards. And for Colleen, the good was what he did for her and also what he did for their daughter, which was to give her life. You know, in some ways, as I was listening to this discussion, I think that ultimately, probably things played out the way they should have after the killings. I think that it probably was appropriate. I'm not sure what good would have been served to keep Bob Rowe in a mental institution for 20 more years. I think he did do some good with his life, but I also think it probably was fair that he didn't be reinstated in the bar. I think that that was a quixotic idea for him, that he felt that he needed to have that so that he could say, look, I really am absolved. Society welcomes me back. But I think as the mothers found out, sometimes fate plays tricks on you. You know, nobody in the mothers group wanted to have children who were blind or who had other handicaps, but that's what happened. So they were not able to recapture their lives as they were before.
Julie Solomon, I Scott Sibbett to say you did a good thing in the writing of this book, Facing the Wind, a story that you cannot resist or read and forget. Thank you, Julie Solomon. The book is Facing the Wind. Thanks also to Dr. Stephen Teach, the lawyer Stephen Scaring, the mothers Rose Morrow and Mady Gaskin. Thanks to New England Streaming Media for audio streaming into the Berkman Center for Law and Society at the Harvard Law School. Our webcast was produced at the BMP studios of the Christian Science Monitor by Tom Tiger, Amy McDonald, Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hattie, and Jake Shapiro, with Noel Flatt and Morgan Anderson and Jeremy Bowers. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Please visit us at our website at christopherlydon.org.